Accession number 8668, roll number 2.
Mrs. Mogridge, reel 2. How did you get on with the... Were they boys, young boys?
Yes, they were up to about 24. There was one 16-year-old who was doing engineering. They were all doing engineering, in fact. There were only two pilots who were flying at the aeronaut as a student, flying student. There were two that were English. There were two that were Indians, which horrified my poor mother because she kept saying they'll take you to a field and, you know, and you don't know what will happen. Don't ever fly with them.
How did you feel about that?
Well, it took me a bit of time. It took me a bit of time to get used to that because I liked the Negroes, but I was terrified of the Indians. For some reason, I was terrified of them. In South Africa, they have Indian shops, you know, rows of Indian shops. And they all smelt of, I know what now I know is curry, but at that time I didn't know what it smelt like. And it just made me feel sick every time because I have a malfunctioning liver, which is another thing. Just before my mother decided to send me to England, they suggested I have a medical before I go, a very severe medical done with the Royal Air Force in South Africa, the South African Air Force. And they said that I was very healthy, but I did have a malfunctioning liver, which could be a problem. You know, it could make me feel sick. And funnily enough, only when I'm not flying myself. Otherwise, it's no problem. But that's why I didn't like instructing. I felt a bit sick when they do peculiar things, you know.
But the college still accepted you?
Oh, the college would have, because it was very expensive to go to an aeronautical college, and they wanted the money. Oh, yes. But, well, the report that I was physically fit, really. A malfunctioning liver is just one of those things. You know, some people, you're born with it. Not much you can do about it.
Did you have to pass any tests? Did you have to do a flight?
Yes. You always have a medical test. No, a medical test you have to have always when you go and learn to fly anyway. And you have to go on having medical tests. In fact, for commercial licenses, professional licenses, ALTPs and things, you have to have them every 6 months, and then you also have checks. I mean, they really are very, very fussy, and your health's the most important thing, and it's the most frightening thing because so many pilots, they think they're fully qualified pilots, they've been flying for, say, 10 years, they go and have one medical, which they have to have regularly, and they say, sorry, you've got a murmuring heart, that's the end of your flying career, and all the money they've spent on training. And it's about £60,000 to train a pilot, you know, just to start them. They're not good enough to fly as captain or anything like that, just to become sort of first officer. So you have to be medically fit. And when the Air Force turn them down, people say, oh, that's not rubbish, you know. But they really have to. It's so important.
But you weren't too bothered about your liver malfunction?
Well, I had to be very careful. It was fine as long as I didn't have too much sugar, as long as I didn't have too many chocolates, which I lived on by good chance, and as long as I didn't drink, which I don't anyway, and just careful what I eat, lots of fruit and vegetables.
Right, you were saying that there were two other boys learning to fly.
Yes,
English boys. How did they react to you learning as well?
Well, actually, they were all right because mainly I think they didn't really take me seriously, quite honestly. One was the one who was 24. He was doing both. He was doing the engineering and the flying, and you know, whichever one he thought, if he lost his license one way, he'd have an engineer's license, which was a very clever idea, really, because it meant. And he was an Irishman, very tall, very glamorous, very good looking, and he took me to church the day off I arrived. And he said he hadn't been to church for years, but he very kindly took me to church. And he was very used to sort of treat me like, well, I was a new child. He was 24, and I thought he was terribly old, you know. 16, you do, don't you? And he was very scathing about me, you know what I mean? he wasn't. I just kept away from them really because I couldn't take their cynicism. I just couldn't take it. I didn't know how to answer. But I'd never been with people like that. And funnily enough, during the war, he was taken as a prisoner. And I had a letter from him saying, by that time I'd become engaged to my husband, Reg. I was 18. And he wrote this letter to me through the ATA and said that although he'd always been rather nasty to me, he realizes now that I was only a small, young, little virgin and I didn't know much about life. And he appreciated it. And would I wait for him? And would I like to be engaged by post? Which I thought was so funny. I didn't say two words to him, really.
What about the instructors?
Oh, yes, we had an instructor now. He was 24, also thought he was old. And he was a very quiet man, Mr. Ollie. And he never said a word. And the very first time we did a cross-country, he just said, we're going from there to there. But he didn't tell me. I suppose it was the navigation instructors was at fault, really. He should have shown me how to go from one place to the other. Because mostly the course I did was engineering, you know, not so much the actual navigation. So, of course, the correspondence course, I mean. So, of course, when I did my first navigation course, which was from Oxford to Cheltenham, I just got lost because I didn't know what to do. He never explained. He didn't even show me how the compass worked. He thought I should know, I suppose. Well, I knew it all theoretically, but it's quite different in an aeroplane. Nobody tells you it swings from side to side and you've just got to get the general. You didn't have all the instruments you have now, you know, which is a gyro, which you can set and stays put. And England is very difficult to navigate. Not like the first cross-country I did on my solo in South Africa with a lovely blue sky. And you've got one road to follow. England, you take off hundreds of railways, thousands of roads, fog, low cloud, drizzle, clouds, more fog, and, you know, you just don't know where you are. You've really got to follow it minutely on the map. But he never explained that. So, of course, I got lost. And he, only then he sort of said, oh, well, it shouldn't be over there, it shouldn't be over there, head that way. And that's about all he ever said.
He was with you?
Yes. Oh, yes, he has to be. You know, this is the first time I ever went up to do a cross. But instead of getting me together and doing it and showing me before I took off, he didn't do anything. He just put me in the aeroplane and said, we're now going to Cheltenham, and gave me a map. Well, it didn't mean anything. I saw the line on the map. But funnily enough, navigation is something you have to absorb. You can't just do it. You have to absorb it again. It's like reading ordinary reading and writing. It's a new element and you have to absorb it. And unless you do, you can't navigate, because when I look at a map now, I'm automatically reading it like I read a book. But then it didn't mean anything, you see. I mean, he didn't explain that was a church and that was a thing and that was something else and that was something else. If he'd done that to me, I'd have known, well, I've got to keep that church on the left and that on the so-and-so and that on the something. Of course, nowadays you don't do that anymore. You just fly on a chart that's a radio chart, which gives you all, a radio facility chart, which gives you all the beacons, and you just fly from beacon to beacon, etc., which is entirely different again. There's another reason why I got in my sort of job I do these days is really valuable, because I'm one of the few pilots who doesn't need a crew, and I can fly anywhere with just a map. As long as I've got a map, I don't even need radio aids. I can get there.
When you first started flying on your own, were you worried about getting lost?
Absolutely petrified. The first day he sent me up solo, he told me to go and do some aerobatics, you see. So I went up to do some aerobatics. And there again, this was even before I did the navigation to Cheltenham. I came out of my loop-a-loop and things, and suddenly I couldn't see the airfield anywhere, just masses of railways and trees and things, but no sign of an airfield. And then finally I saw a long strip, and I thought, well, that looks like a runway. I'm going to go and land on it because my petrol's running low. So I went and landed on this runway, and it was Brize Norton, which is only a few miles away from Whitney. And funnily enough, they were just building it then. RAF station they were just building. So the men all came up to me, they were building the runway, and said, very surprised to see a little girl get out of this aeroplane. And we rang up Whitney, and the instructor came, picked me up and took me back. But you see, nobody there, again, if I'd done the same thing in South Africa, the aerobatics and everything, it's the visibility is clear, and there's only one airfield, and you can see it for miles, you see. It's very difficult in England, navigation.
And presumably you hadn't been to England before, so you...
Oh, no. I'd only been in there 3 days. This is my third day, and they sent me up to do, you know, aerobatics.
What were you given instruction in?
We had about three different types of aeroplanes. One was an enclosed one, like a cabin aeroplane, a four-seater, like a gypsy moth or something. No, sorry, not a gypsy moth, like a puss moth. That was a two-seater. And then we had another little four-seater, which was called a Winkworth, American thing. And then we had a tiger moth. And I mostly learnt on the tiger moth because you could aerobat it. It wasn't easy to fly, you know. If you learnt to fly on a tiger moth, you found that you could fly more any aeroplane because it was one of those aeroplanes you really had to fly. You had to balance it on a pin, as I said before. But if you flew a clumsy sort of aeroplane, which... it wasn't sensitive, you know, and you could just come in and land it easily, then you couldn't fly any type. You couldn't fly a Spitfire, you'd never make it, because the Spitfire was a very difficult aeroplane to actually... It was so sensitive, you know, you couldn't be ham-handed with it. And so we found that there were two types of aeroplanes in those days, too. There was one called a Magister, which was... newer than the tiger moth, which everyone learned to fly on. And that was very easy to fly. It was low on the ground, and you came in, and as long as you plonked it down somehow, it stayed. A tiger moth, unless you did it perfectly, it used to billow up and float. But the people who trained on Magisters during the war, we found, they never made really good ferry pilots, because they hadn't learned to actually fly the aeroplane by the seat of their pants, if you know what I mean. Now, the people who learned on tiger moths, even the Air Force people, were very good ferry pilots, because the tiger moth was the most difficult to fly. So if you could fly a tiger moth perfectly, you could fly almost anything, because everything else seemed so easy. Do you know? And you had the touch.
What had you been flying in South Africa?
Same sort of thing, yes. Same sort of, well, it's the same as England, you see, exactly the same. It was British. So everything we had here, we had there. In fact, everything was the same. Our education was the same. We had the same education in South Africa as you have in England. We had either Oxford or Cambridge. I think we did Oxford in my school. You know, if you could go to Oxford if you wanted to. And some of the schools did Cambridge. But the education was exactly the same. It's only now, when we handed it back to the Dutch... the Afrikaans, we call them, that South Africa has changed its educational system.
So you didn't find much change coming to the aeronautical college?
No, not at all. In fact, it wasn't any different, really, from South Africa, except the weather was bad. And I didn't see the sun for the first 6 weeks I got here.
And you were taught navigation?
Oh, everything. It's navigation, engineering... you had to do a certain amount of engineering, not to be an engineer, but you had to know the theory of it and more or less, you know, what it was all about and how it functioned. And you have to anyway as a pilot. You have to know all that. You have 13 subjects when I first started, actually. Now I think they've cut a lot of it out and it's much easier to get a license.
And did you take any tests?
Well, no, because, you see, the war came and I didn't have time to do the tests. I was doing them on the November and war broke out in the September.
What happened to you when war broke out?
Well, as soon as war broke... a month before war broke... Oh, before that, this is also something to do with the war, when people began to get worried about the war, the government brought out a scheme called the Civil Air Guard, and all pilots were being trained... in the Civil Air Guard. So they tried to train as many pilots as they could in the Civil Air Guard, which you wore a sort of RAF coloured uniform, all in one, like without a trousers and top, you know, just all in one. And like we used to call a siren suit in the war. Now that, and you wore some sort of wings called Civil Air Guard wings. and you were being taught to fly so many hours paid by the government, which I thought was a brilliant idea. But as I was already flying anyway, they asked me to join because it was good, and you know. So I used to have a few hours free flying lessons, and a few people joined that, including Marigold. In fact, I had a letter from somebody once who wanted to know if I knew any other civil air guards, because he was doing a collection of it. And so when war broke out, everybody, including people in the civil air guard, had a letter to say if you were a woman, you were told that you were to stand by as a ferry or ambulance pilot. Somewhere I might have that letter. The men were told they had to stand by to join the Royal Air Force. So I was thrilled to bits, and I hoped we'd have a war. So when war actually broke out, everything was stopped. My money from South Africa was stopped. Everything was stopped. And so I put in to join the Air Force, you know, as they said, as an ambulance. And then I wrote, and they wrote back and said, even with my age added on 2 years out, they said I was too young.
How old did you say you were?
I was 1939 the war broke out, yes. I was 17, that's right, because I joined the WEFs. I was just allowed to join the WEFs. I'd been 17 from the March before. That's the March before.
But you said you were 19.
Well, yes. I didn't to the WEF, but I did to the Aeronautical College, yes. I was scared to do it to the WEF. Anyway, they said that I was too young, you know. And, I mean, even if I'd added it would have been too young. They wanted people of 24 plus, you see. But they said, as you've got, you know, as you're being to an aeronautical college, we can use you in special branch of the Royal Air Force, and we want you to join the Royal Air Force as soon as possible, and we'll know where to find you if ever we need pilots that desperately. So that's what I did. So I joined the Royal Air Force in November, actually. I think it was November the 11th, if I'm not wrong. And then they put me, which is rather a joke, that they put me with another girl to look after some officers in domestic duties, and I hadn't done a thing in my life about domestic duties. And I was walking with the CO, because he was showing me where I had to go in my... We only had Macintoshes and a beret. That was our uniform. They hadn't had time to make any uniforms. So I had this funny old Macintosh on in a beret, walking with the squadron leader, and a warrant officer walked past and saluted the squadron leader. So I didn't. I'd never had any lessons or anything, so I promptly saluted back. Which apparently that story came back to me afterwards. The squadron leader said, you know, in my ignorance, I'd taken the salute of the warrant officer who was saluting the CO of the station. Well, you know, that's how new and hurried everything was, you see. We were put in and then trained. So then they sent me for... It was 2 weeks I spent supposedly cooking for these people, because I didn't know. She said she wanted some cabbage, and it was in the garden, so I went and cut it and shoved it in a saucepan. Don't know.
You'd not learn to cook at home?
Oh, no, in South Africa nobody ever does, you know. Well, at least not the girls, don't do anything. And so that wasn't very successful. But then they sent us for 3 weeks training, saluting and marching up and down. And then they decided what they were going to do with us. And because of my experience, they did. They took me to this radar station at Bordsey Manor and trained me as a radar operator.
Did you know you were going to be doing
that? No, they had no idea. They didn't tell you what it was, because, you see, if you failed, it was a secret. They did say that on no account were we to say who we were, what we were, and what we were doing. And if anyone asked us, we were cooks. And it was quite true to say that, because, after all, that's what I joined up as, which was a laugh, really, but, you know, they put us down as cooks.
And what did you have to do for the work as a radar officer?
Well, they put us in these little quiet... To train, do you mean? When we were training, they put us in a little hut, each in a little cabin sort of thing, in this lovely big old Bordsey Manor. And I thought it was on an island, if I can remember. I'm sure they rowed us across to it. And then... they had it done out in cubicles, really, if you know what I mean. And those cubicles each had a radar screen, which is like a television set. Well, it's really television, isn't it? But instead of a picture, you see a very wiggly line going across the middle, a whole lot of wiggly lines going across the middle. And somewhere in those wiggly lines, you have to find what they called an echo, which was a little dash. little V-shaped thing which kept popping up every now and again, and that was the, afterwards we learned, was the aircraft that you were to try and DF, that means direction find. So you had this little wheel at the side, and you did it so that the echo would disappear. As soon as it disappeared, you looked at your wheel and noted the direction it was coming from, which it was coming, and the height it was at, and all that. And that was the enemy aircraft approaching, or whichever you could see. You didn't always know it was enemy aircraft. Later on, they had an identification. If you saw the echo, every second or two, there'd be a long line coming away from it and going up. That long line was the identification saying that it was a enemy aircraft. Otherwise, it was our aircraft. The identification was our aircraft. And if you saw that, you didn't bother any longer. But if it was didn't have an identification, then you had to call up the in your mouth headphones and say, we've got an echo at such and such a height, such and such a direction, heading, etc. And then they would plot it on a plotting machine, and they'd know exactly where that aircraft was coming from, where it was approaching, and what speed it was doing, you see. You could even give it speed later on, because you could see the echo. And then you stayed on that thing for an hour. And then from there, you transferred to something else, which was the reading of that, as you DF'd it, you see. And then you stayed on that for an hour. And then there was a third thing, which was the telephone, and you stayed on that for an hour. And then when we left Bawdsey Manor, we went to these little huts. That's when we had the little huts in the wilds of Romney Marsh at Rye, I was, and these great big pylons sticking up. And that's when they told us that they were aircraft we were DFing. So it could have been ships. Well, they did have ones for ships too, of course. They were near to the coast, etc. And they only got below a certain 1,000 feet. But above 1,000 feet, we did everything above 1,000 feet. And then you could tell. Now, I was one of my last days on duty. It was the middle of the night, and I put it in my book. There were dozens and dozens of echoes. Now, just to make life really complicated, you also got all the balloons on these screens, so you had to know exactly. That's why you had to be trained, and that's why they were reluctant to let me go, you know, to fly, because they felt I was trained and they needed me. They needed all of us, not just me. And all these, you could see the various mountains and whatever you could see, you know, you had to know those so that you could tell the echo was different from those. Well, I saw hundreds of echoes, and I called up Stanmore, which was the station you called up, and I said to Stanmore, I've got a whole lot of people, aircraft approaching. I'm sure it must be aircraft because, you know, they're coming nearer each time. And so they said, you must be mistaken, Ryan, you must be half asleep. I'll see what the other stations are giving, but it seemed to be just us. Anyway, I kept repeating, you know, giving them the thing, and the next day they apologized and said I was correct. And it was the first wave of bombers that were starting to come over England. And it just so happened I was on duty that night. And, you know, they're very difficult to convince people that, or to convince Stanmore, because in the middle of the night everybody's half asleep, you know, and you've been on duty 8 hours. We did shifts of three. 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours. We had three crews, if you know what I mean. But in the beginning, we only had two crews, which was terribly difficult because we had to do... Well, we used to try and sleep, have an odd person sleeping while the other person, people were on duty. It's the only way we'd get our sleep. So every 4 hours, you got up and went on duty. And then you went and slept again. And we were very badly fed, miles from anywhere, didn't have any proper uniforms. We had... We just had these Macintoshes with a beret. Later on, they gave us uniforms. And then I did that for 10 months, actually. But halfway through, about the seventh month that I'd been there, a letter came round saying that I had to go and have a flying test at Hatfield, where the ferry pool was, with a view to me becoming a ferry pilot. So I went. And I had to do three landings. I did three landings just by sheer luck, not having flown for all that time. And they were all right. So she said, oh, fine, you've passed the test. When can you start? So I said, well, I'm an operator, radar operator. We were terribly, desperately short of radar operators. They were trying to train them as fast as they could. You see, if they could tell people what it was, they might have done it better, but because they didn't tell you unless you passed, I for one, you know, didn't know what it was all about. So it wasn't easy, really, to train them. It took 3 weeks, and sometimes it took longer.
Was the training rigorous?
Oh, yes, you didn't get much free time. Well, they were trying to get you as quickly as possible. However, when I went back to the radar station, said I'd passed, and that CO there told the Baroness, somebody or other, who was the head of our section of the Royal Women's Air Force, Auxiliary Air Force, as we were called, the WAF. And she said, she came down, and she said, in no way was I going to leave the radar. It was terribly important. They needed every man, woman, and child to do the radar, if you know what I mean. And that, as far as she was concerned, you know, it wasn't anybody could fly. However, Pauline Gower was furious because she said, no, flying had priority over anything. You could train a radar operator in 3 weeks. You had to train a pilot in 3 years to be any good. So anyway, they had this fight. And for 3 months, I didn't know, of course, that they were having this fight. I just knew I couldn't be a pilot. And then 3 months later, I had another instruction to say that I was now going to be a ferry pilot and that it had priority. And that was the day I met Reg, actually, because I went to that party.
Had you written to the ATA?
No, not again. I mean, I didn't know that. I always obey authority. I was a very timid person. I still am a bit. I'm always, you know, I always have great respect for authority. And if people say you can't do it, that's it. I knew I couldn't do it. And I thought, well, if I'm more important to England here, obviously I'm going to do it. You know, I was quite proud of the fact that I was in the Air Force and I was doing a job that was important. As far as I was concerned, I mean, anything that I thought that I was good at, I was so stupid. I thought, you know, I was pleased to be felt that I was needed. I didn't really, you know, I was very disappointed, but I didn't say too much about it, and I didn't know there was anything else I could do about it. And then it was Pauline Gower who was doing the fighting, and I didn't know that, between this Baroness woman and her. And she won. Well, apparently flying does hold, is above everything, because we were desperately short of pilots. They never would have used women if they needed, if they weren't, you see. Which is the usual thing. It's a man's world, isn't it?
This must have been very near the beginning of the ATA.
Yes, yes it was, because I joined on the 29th of July, 1940. And that was the day that I joined the ATA, and I did my first landing, takeoff and landing, and the next day I went to Scotland. And then we had no maps. We had one map between five people, so five of us had to take these five aeroplanes up to Scotland. So they said, I was so scared of all these very glamorous looking women, and they were, you know, they were mostly sort of socialites who could afford to fly for pleasure, and they all looked absolutely gorgeous, you know, all beautifully sophisticated and beautiful long tapered fingernails and beautiful makeup. And poor timid little ugly me, you know, I felt terribly out of it.